How many of you enjoy going to weddings? Okay. Let's try that again. How many of you enjoy going to weddings? The guys' hands are just kind of, well, the women are, yeah, let's go. I think everybody enjoys a wedding. And I think probably it is one of the customs that we have maintained throughout the history of this earth. It's a very sacred time. It's a very special time. It's a time of, usually it's a time of happiness and joy. I don't think I've ever been to a wedding that wasn't very upbeat and very exciting, and people just tend to have a good time. Usually they really break loose afterwards at the reception, at the banquet that follows the wedding. And there's something I've noticed, and I've done a number, actually quite a few weddings over the years, and I enjoy doing weddings. They are one of the things that makes the job as a pastor a very joyful and wonderful experience. But I've noticed one thing, especially at the banquets. People are very careful who they invite to the receptions. Well, who they invite to the weddings, but especially to the receptions. And I don't know if that has anything to do with people feeling free to say whatever they need to say or what they want to say about the groom and the bride. But there is a time that people often kind of hold their breath a little bit. And I've noticed one thing, a number of times I've noted that every family has somebody who you might consider a rebel. And they often are accompanied by either a cousin or maybe an uncle named Bob that weighs 325 pounds and has been assigned to sit with Cousin Goober to make sure that he doesn't get out of hand, to make sure that if he says something embarrassing or he grosses everybody out, that this person can either suggest that they leave the room or can manhandle the person to get him out of the room to make sure he doesn't ruin the wedding. Nobody wants a ruined wedding, right? Nobody wants Uncle Goober to say something that might embarrass the family or embarrass the bride or the groom. And so it's interesting because I have noted that, and even in my own family I noticed that there was some of that going on. And so I think that people who often we call rebels are individuals who don't always follow the guidelines or the socially accepted guidelines of what you should or shouldn't do at a wedding. They're kind of free spirits. Now, when you think of a rebel, what comes into your mind? What thought comes through your mind? What word comes through your mind? Or what sentence do you think of? What is a rebel? Okay, a rule breaker. Someone who kind of has a sense of their own set of rules of what is acceptable or what is normal. Now, I know in my community up in Ukiah, it's known, at least in the past, its reputation was that it was a sort of a redneck community. I didn't realize we had rednecks in Southern California, but until I moved to Ukiah, and then I realized that we did. And there's this one guy in particular that lives about five blocks from us up at the foot of the mountain, and he lives in kind of, it's a small little ranch that he's built up. He's got goats and he has cows and he has horses, and he has a big, huge diesel four-wheel drive Ford truck. And you can hear him coming for miles. You can hear the whistling of the turbine and the growling of the diesel. And planted squarely in the back of the truck is a huge rebel flag. He flies this thing all over town. Everywhere that truck goes, you see this huge, huge flag just flying in the wind. And he's advertising that he's a rebel. Doesn't matter that the Civil War ended, you know, over 100 years ago. He's going to let everybody know where he stands, and he is on the side of the South. And so I would say most of us, when we think of a rebel, we think of someone who opposes the norms of society. Someone who is not quite willing to follow the status quo. And generally, they do not operate within the social/political norms of society. They're not, well, I guess what we call politically correct often. They challenge the authority figures of society. And they also, they kind of think differently, at least in my experience has been in questioning or talking to people. For everything that is, for every reality that they see in life, there are at least 100 could-bes. 100 other things that could have happened, that should have happened. And they're not afraid to let you know that they should have happened. And they, they tend to favor the underdog. They're not afraid to say what they're thinking. And you say, well, you're kind of being harsh on them this morning. Well, think about this for a minute. When you think of a rebel, or you think of someone who tends to think outside of the box, someone who tends to think about the options in life, what are some of the names that you might come up with throughout history? I have a whole list of them. I'm sorry? Okay. Martin Luther shook up the whole world. Started a reformation that's still continuing on today. Great man of God. Brought about the change in the religious world today. How about people like Huss and Jerome and John Knox and John Calvin, Charles Wesley, William Miller, Gandhi, Sister Teresa, Martin Luther King. The list goes on and on and on and on. All of us know or have heard of someone who's willing to stand up against the norm in society and to be counted. It's interesting, if you study the lives of these individuals, you'll note that seldom are they appreciated by the majority in society. In fact, often they're persecuted, and yes, they are martyred. They are truly great people who think outside of the box and often are visionaries. They often have the ability to move groups of people to act, to do things. They're movers and shakers. Unfortunately, they're often seen as troublemakers by the status quo thinkers. But most do have a sense, or rather most do not have a sense, of their greatness. And often their greatness is not celebrated until after they die or later on in their lives. As I thought about rebels, I, of course, thought of many different individuals. The list that I just gave you would be those who I believe would be considered good rebels. Then we look at others who we would not consider good rebels, men like Hitler, men like Gaddafi, people who have brought much pain and suffering in the world that we live in today. And so we have healthy rebels and unhealthy rebels. Healthy rebels are people who are giving of themselves. They're people who are kind. They're people who are thoughtful of others. People who are willing to place the good of others ahead of their own safety and goodwill. They're often polite. And as I was studying and reading and just kind of browsing through the various individuals that I mentioned here, I came up with one common denominator. Most of the people who are healthy rebels were people who are humble. My wife's grandfather was a man who I have always looked up to and admired and appreciated, miss him terribly, and often think about him, even though he's passed on. And one of the things that he shared with me one time was that he had the privilege, a couple of times actually, to visit Gandhi while he was a missionary in India. And his impressions that he got as he visited, as he talked to this very, truly very great man, a man who left an incredible impact on his own country, was the one word that he used to describe Gandhi was humble. Very humble. As I've, over the years, met people who I would consider great people, great leaders, whether they are in the secular world or in the spiritual world, I've also truly discovered that they are often very humble people. They're not necessarily conscious of their greatness. They're not conscious. They're more concerned with helping others. They're truly willing to be the last in line rather than the first. On the other hand, all of us at some point in our lives have met an unhealthy rebel. A person whose only concern is for themselves. They are not humble. They're very egocentric. They're very self-centered. They're self-serving. They're abusive. They are toxic. And one word that would describe them would be narcissist. What's amazing is, as I've over the years talked with them and counseled with some, they haven't a clue that they have this condition. It's amazing. When you sit down and talk to them, they are blinded. They are blinded by their own narcissism. They don't realize that they have this condition. They don't realize that their attitude affects other people and often hurts other people. And when you try to explain it to them because of their narcissistic condition, they tend to want to blame other people for their problem. In fact, they will even turn on you and say, well, you know, I don't think that's true. I'm not the narcissist. Look at, I do this, I do that. They always want to argue the point. Now we come to the story here in Luke, the 14th chapter. And I asked myself this question as I read the story. I asked myself this question. Actually, I want to begin with 13:31. Luke 13, verse 31. Here the Pharisees have come to Jesus, and these, of course, are the spiritual leaders of Israel. These are the true saints of Israel. These are the ones who strut the streets of Jerusalem proudly with their heads held high, because they are truly the righteous leaders. They are truly the thinkers. They are truly the ones who understand God and can expound on the Word of God. These are the ones that judge others. These are the ones that, well, yes, condemn others. And they come to Jesus here and they say, leave this place and go somewhere else. Why? Because Herod wants to kill you. It's interesting because I'm not so sure Herod really cared that much about Jesus. Herod was truly a narcissist. He had no idea what was really probably going on down on the grassroots of his kingdom. What they were really saying is, we would like to kill you. And you say, well, how do you know that? Well, let's go from there over to chapter 14, beginning with verse 1. And on the Sabbath, when Jesus went to eat in the house of a prominent Pharisee? Have you ever wished that you knew the name of that person? Wouldn't it be neat if we knew who that was? A prominent Pharisee. He was not just a Pharisee. He was the Pharisee of Pharisees. This guy was a saint, a walking saint. He was perfect. He kept the law perfectly. He did all the right things. He said all the right things. And so here, Jesus has come. He's been invited to this place. And you know it's a setup. How do you know that? Because here it says, he was invited to this prominent Pharisee's home, and he was being carefully watched. You see, Luke is letting us know that this was very uncommon. In fact, this was unheard of for Jesus to be invited to a Pharisee's home. So I smell a setup here, really. What I see here is they've invited Jesus to a very prominent Pharisee's home so that all of them could gather and they could watch him. They could kind of, you know, and you see these guys all standing around, kind of like mafia bosses, you know. Hey, Tony, you know. They're all standing around and they're watching Jesus. They're waiting to see what Jesus is going to do. And what's interesting, and once again, I think there's an added dimension to this. Because they not only invite Jesus to this prominent Pharisee's home and they stand around and watch, but they also place someone who is sick and unclean and obviously a sinner, a man suffering from dropsy. I think Jesus obviously saw what was happening here. He was no fool. He knew that this invitation to come to the Pharisee's house was probably a setup. And sure enough, he gets there. All the guys are standing around in their black robes with their little tiny prayer boxes on their foreheads and their arms are crossed, and they're watching every move that Jesus makes. And they have placed someone here in the room to see if Jesus would break the law of Sabbath keeping. I mean, I think it's significant that they would even have a feast on Sabbath. Most of the time, they would fast on Sabbath. Here they're having a feast on Sabbath, and Jesus is the honored guest, and he's brought in, he's a setup, he's being framed, and they put somebody there to see if he will break the Sabbath. And what does he do? Does he do the politically correct thing? Does he bow and scrape to their understanding of how the Sabbath should be kept? Does he make sure that he checks the Torah and make sure that he checks with the scribes and Pharisees? Oh, what shall I do? What shall I do? Here's a man that is sick. He's in the room. I need to heal him. Do you think I should heal him on Sabbath? Jesus doesn't talk to anyone. What does he do? Well, he does ask a question. And this is the question he asks. Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? He knows good and well that it's not lawful. He's asking a question that he knows the answer, according to the Pharisees and the scribes. But he's asking this question because he has more to say. He's setting them up in a sense. They have come to trick him and to somehow trap him, and Jesus turns it around on them. And what does he say? He asks them a question. Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? And what was their response? Smart guys. It says they remained silent. And so taking hold of the man, he healed him and sent him away. You know, I'm so glad that Jesus, when he came to this earth, was a rebel. He came to a world that was so sick and so corrupted and so twisted and totally dysfunctional. He came to turn it around and to show what the kingdom of heaven was really all about, where the priorities of the kingdom of heaven were. And the priorities of the kingdom of heaven is not to keep all the little laws and all the little, you know, sacred traditions that everybody thinks they have to have. He was there to manifest the will of his Father, and the will of his Father was a much higher calling. He was called to minister to humanity. And so he did. He healed this man in the face of the norm of society, in the face of the teachings of the Pharisees and the Sadducees, in the face of the religious leaders. Jesus broke the rules and he healed on the Sabbath. Of course, he wasn't done yet. And so he asks another question. If one of you has a son or an ox that falls into a well on the Sabbath, will you not immediately pull him out? And what was their response? Nothing. They had nothing to say. Why? Because Jesus turned their sick mentality, their sick, twisted theology, their sick, twisted traditions, he turned them around on them. And they realized that they were trapped. They had come to trap Jesus, and he had turned around and trapped them. And they were left thinking. They were actually embarrassed. I bet that was probably one of the shortest feasts that they ever had. They could probably hardly wait to get Jesus out of there. They could hardly wait to usher him out, because he had embarrassed them in front of their own peers. He had embarrassed them in front of the people. And they were angry at Jesus. But Jesus isn't through yet. By the way, if you wanted to create an uproar at a feast or a banquet or a wedding, just invite Jesus. Do you kind of get it? If you think about all the feasts that Jesus went to, when you think about the weddings that Jesus went to, eventually at some point, Jesus became the hot spot. He became the rebel. He became the uncle who was willing to say what was on his mind. Even Peter and the disciples said, well, Lord, let's move on to the next city. Let's move on to the next town, because they knew they were getting booted out of that town. They had a very clear understanding, a very sense of what society, what was acceptable in society. Jesus was there, a man on a mission. He was there with the orders from headquarters from his Father in heaven. And he didn't let the social norms or the politically correct thing to get in the way of his mission. And so, as we continue in verse chapter 14, we have here Jesus once again in chapter 14, verse 8. When someone invites you, he's talking now to the crowd. He's saying, if someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor. For a person who distinguished then, you may have been invited. Okay, I got to back up. I went over that too fast. Someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor. For a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. If so, the host who invited both of you will come and say to you, give this man your seat. Then, humiliated, you'll have to take the least important place. When you are invited to take the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he will say to you, friend, move up to a better place. Then you will be honored in the presence of all your fellow guests. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. Do you see what Jesus is saying? He's changing the thinking. He's changing the norms in society. He's saying, the way you guys run things, everybody crowds in, everybody runs for the best seat, everybody tries to get on the front row, everybody tries to get the biggest piece of pie, everybody tries to get the best steak, everybody tries to fight for himself. But what I'm telling you is what you need to learn to do is to be humble. Be willing to be last in line rather than first in line. Be willing to look out for the other person. Humble yourself. And then, of course, what follows this message that Jesus is sharing is verse 15. Jesus is talking about a great banquet. And it's a parable. He talks about this banquet and how this man prepares this beautiful banquet and for his friends, and he invites them to come. And as the servants go out to remind these people that they need to come to the banquet, what happens? They all have an excuse. They all have an excuse, and something's more important than coming to this banquet. And finally, in frustration, this rich man who's prepared this beautiful banquet, he tells his servants to go out into the roads and the country lanes and make them make any that they find to come. So that the house will be full, I tell you, not one of those men who were invited will get a taste of my banquet. Do you see what this is talking about? This is once again talking about those who have been invited to the banquet. By the way, this, of course, is the great banquet feast in heaven. Jesus is telling in a parable about the day when he will come and take his people home. Those who are invited to come home to that great feast in heaven, that great banquet in heaven. And what happens? They have excuses. Now let me say something. All of you have been invited. You've all been invited to that great feast in heaven. Personally invited. I hope that you don't have something that's more important than going to that feast. I hope there's not something in your life that you would rather be doing right now than going to heaven. Or something that's taking so much time in your life, something that has a priority in your life that keeps you from that great feast, that banquet in heaven. Because that's really what this is about. This is exactly what Jesus is talking about. And those who were invited did not come to the banquet, and Jesus sent his servants out in the highways and the byways to invite any and all who might come. You see, Jesus had invited the children of Israel to be his special people. He invited them to be part of the kingdom of heaven. And they became so busy. They became so wrapped up in their priorities. And many of those priorities were religious priorities. They became so absorbed in their priorities, in their laws, in their regulations, in their traditions, that they had too many excuses to go to the great feast. And so then Jesus sent the disciples out to all the world to gather in those who are willing to come to the feast of the Lamb. I think when we look at this, we realize the importance of keeping our priorities straight. We realize the importance of keeping the kingdom of heaven and entering that kingdom and being part of that kingdom and feasting in that kingdom as one of the top priorities. It is absolutely the top priority in our lives. There is nothing that you can do. There is nothing that you have that is more important than your eternal salvation. There's nothing, no feast that you could go to, no wedding that you could attend that is more important than attending the feast of the Lamb. And so we look at healthy and unhealthy examples. Here we have examples of people who are unhealthy. The Pharisees, who were so caught up in their own ways, who were so caught up in their own teachings, that didn't even recognize that Jesus was the Son of God. I put down just a couple of things here that might help us grow in our spiritual health. Things that we might ponder, things that we might think about, things we might meditate upon and pray about. And I ask the question, what is spiritual health? The willingness. Spiritual health is the willingness to acknowledge sin and wrong, knowing that God will not shame us. Okay? The willingness to acknowledge sin and wrong, knowing that God will not shame us. The second is confession of our helpless and powerlessness as we recognize sin as a fatal disease. We are born with a sinful nature. We are fatally, fatally diseased by sin. Third, the willingness to receive salvation as a free gift. As a free gift, non-resistance. Don't be resistant to God's healing. It's a free gift. Don't resist God's healing. God can heal you. We have a fatal disease. Jesus came to heal us from that. Only Jesus can do that. It's not Jesus plus me, my works. It's Jesus alone that can heal us. He is the healer of the soul. And then building our self-worth, not on our performance or someone else's opinion, but on what God says about us. You see, our self-worth is not built on our performance. It's not built on what other people say about us. You see, it's built only on what God says about you. You are God's children. You are the sheep of His pasture. You are the flock that He leads, that He loves. You ever seen a flock of sheep? When I drive north of here, there's a certain area around Paris that there are often a huge herd of sheep. And every so often when I drive by, I will see the shepherd holding a lamb. And there's lots of lambs out there. So I think to myself, does he hold them all? Or is he holding only those who are wounded? My guess is he's probably carrying one that's weak or one that's wounded. But that's the way God is with us, you see. We are his sheep. We are his children. He loves us and cares for us. And when we're wounded and when we're hurting, he's willing to pick us up and to hold us and to nurture us and to love us because he cares. He died for us on the cross. And finally, to become spiritually healthy, we must love God with all our hearts, our mind, and soul, trusting in Jesus for everything. We must love the Lord our God with all our hearts and our soul and our mind, and trusting that Jesus and Jesus alone can save us and is coming again to take us home. Now, if you're looking for evidence in your life, we always do. Let's be honest. Maybe in the darkness of the night, in the middle of the night or something, but we're always in our minds thinking, well, how do I know if I'm good enough? You see, maybe I'm not doing something right. Maybe I need to do something better. The evidence of spiritual healthiness is this. Revelation 14:12, the patience of the saints. You see, willingness to wait on the Lord. It takes patience to be one of God's children. Wait upon the Lord. Don't run ahead of him. Don't lag behind. But wait upon the Lord to lead you to green pastures. It's only through waiting upon the Lord that we can ever overcome trials. It's by abiding in Christ Jesus and accepting the difficult situations in our lives and allowing him to work us through those situations that we can be healthy. The second thing that we can look at is the commandments of God, to love God with all our hearts and others as ourselves. Jesus narrowed it down to two. And finally, the faith of Jesus, Revelation 14:12 says, the faith of Jesus. To have the faith of Jesus means to depend on Christ's covenant faithfulness, to trust him for everything. Did you get that? Having the faith of Jesus is to depend on Christ's covenant faithfulness. He covenanted with us. He said, I will be faithful. I will be with you even to the end of the earth. That is a covenant he made with his disciples. That is a covenant he's made with us. He will not break that covenant. God has always kept every single covenant that he's ever made. He will not let you down. You can count on that. And we need to depend. We need to depend on Christ's covenant faithfulness and trust him for everything. And finally, spiritual health is to know that our God is big enough to handle anything in our life. Our God is big enough to handle anything in our life. And it's this truth that saves us from the life-damaging consequences of trying to play God. Jesus came to this feast, and he was supposed to be trapped, and yet he turned that, what could have been a very damaging experience, he turned it around and turned it into a beautiful sermon on the good news of the kingdom, the good news of being part of God's kingdom here on this earth. The hope that that brings, the joy that that brings. Let's praise God. Let's praise him for his goodness, for his love and his mercy and his grace.